What's 20 times 52? What is it? 1,040. Somewhere in there. Well, it's hard to believe that it's been somewhere around that many Shabbats since Eddie Santoro left town. And if you were here then, and you're hearing me, you're still here. And if I'm here saying that it's been 1,000, how many? Shabbats, maybe more, I can't think of exactly how long it's been, then I must still be here. And that may be more notable than it seems to you, that you're still here, and I'm still here. So, as usual, we need to pray. Father, I ask you for your help. I thank you that you are our Father, and that has to do with everything, and everything has to do with that. That you're in charge of everything. You have power over everything. You have authority over everything. You've given all authority in heaven and earth to your Son, who is one with you. And we are in him, and he is in you, and so we're in it together, and you'll never leave us. And so I ask you, Father, to help me to look like a man whose father will never leave him. That is what my life would display, that I have a father that will never leave me, who is bigger than everyone else's dad, and bigger than me, bigger than my fears, bigger than whatever comes against me, way bigger than Goliath, whom you gave David, that little runt, the faith to go and slay. So I ask you, Lord, whatever else happens here today, that you speak to us all, that you speak to us fathers, about just who you are, just who you've made us to be, and that we would stop equivocating about any of what you've made us to be and told us about ourselves, that hey, what you've done is reality. I thank you. I ask you to bring encouragement and blessing, and I ask you to make use of me, Lord, and give me the grace I need right now. And glorify yourself with me, with everyone here, with all of us. And I ask that you'd give us a sense of excited expectation about the rest of the journey. In Yeshua's name, amen. someone interpret that? Maybe I couldn't hear it. So sometimes I give messages titles, sometimes I come up with three or four titles, sometimes I forget altogether that there could be a title. This may be a combination of all of that. But one of the titles is Not Even Life. Not Even Life. And why do you suppose I'm thinking of that as a possible title?
Neither life nor death.
Yes. I want to say something else besides what I'm going to say, which I thought of saying before and then momentarily forgot about. I just want to tell you that it's a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to be the person God made me to be, though I have moaned and groaned and not been very happy about a number of aspects of that for way longer than I should have. I just want to clarify something. I've told you all over the years about my struggle about being a preacher or a pastor, whatever that word was that I associated my greatest fear with when I was a kid. And I'm not sure if the impression I've given you is that I was unwilling to do something. God told me that's what was going to happen to me. I ran from it, and that I've never accepted it, never wanted it, and still hate it. Have I given you that impression? What? Well, that's good. That's encouraging. So I imagine in terms of life on earth, the biggest privilege there is to do what God gave you to do. And that's probably the best, no, not probably, that is the best thing for anybody to be doing, is the thing God gave them to do. If I've been through trouble with you and you've been through trouble with me and you remember some of it and some of it was horrible and you thought I was a monster or you thought God was right and he was using me to be a, irritation or whatever it was you may have thought, whatever it is we've all gone through, it's all been a privilege. It's all a gift from God. The trouble, the stuff that didn't look like trouble, the stuff that seemed neutral, the laughs, the tears, the bumps, the scrapes, the misunderstandings. It seems to me there isn't any material I've discovered, whether it's made of what we think of as matter or just thoughts or whatever, that God can't use to teach us something and to bring himself glory. I'm happy with the journey. I want to apologize to all of you for the moments where I displayed the worst aspects of myself and robbed myself, you, and perhaps God of what should have been. But at the same time, just in general, I would say we don't have the choice in life to not go through stuff where we wish we would have done better, where we wish we would have taken hold of the grace God gave us and done something that looked more heroic or more victorious, or actually maybe a lot of time we just wish it made us look better and we didn't look so bad some of the time. But when I do something that makes me look bad, that does probably increase the chances that God will clearly get the glory when the glory is revealed. So at any rate, once again, I just want to say it's not perfection in the journey that really has anything to do with what God's up to. It's not perfection that's required for God to do his will and to glorify his name and to perfect you. That's funny, isn't it? Perfection is not required for God to perfect you. In fact, I think it's a prerequisite that you don't have that for God's perfecting power to work. And different temperaments exist. You know, I'm probably more kind of a rule breaker, so I'm not necessarily so concerned about what all the rules are, because I'm probably going to break a bunch of them anyway. But there are people that want to know all the rules. They want to memorize every rule. And then they're going to absolutely adhere to every rule so that there is never an occasion where they will need to be corrected. And that's not the particular trap I fall into. I sometimes go look up the rules when it seems like people are telling me I've broken all of them. I think, oh, maybe, what, did I break something? I wasn't aware of a rule. But it's a trap. I mean, both, every extreme is always a trap. So, I remember a discussion, I think it's in the Talmud, they're trying to decide how many commandments were in the Torah. My favorite part of that thing that I've looked at is that one guy said this number, another guy said that number, and one of them threw up his hands and said, who could know? And that's where I stand on that one. I think the number of commandments is infinite because they're not about the specific technical. Some of them are, but the thing is it always goes beyond that. It's not about the specific technical thing that you can figure out and then avoid ever breaking it so that you're not in error. Because it becomes something that can be generalized and transferred into situations that the scriptures speak nothing about. Like how to use your cell phone. Whether it's acceptable to use cell phones instead of stones when stoning someone who has committed a capital sin. I don't know whether the Torah perhaps would accept cell phones as stones in a stoning. I don't know why I came up with that one, maybe because it's just so bizarre. But the fact is you can't know every rule and obey it ahead of time so that you never need correction. And if you're trying to, see, you're already in need of correction. Because it's a totally wrong approach to what pleases God. Just as not caring about any rules and not giving a rip whether you break them all is no better. What is good is to have freedom in your life, whether your temperament is on one end or on the other end. That's good. Freedom is good. The scriptures say, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. For the rule-oriented, for the non-rule-oriented, for me, for the person that's opposite me, there's liberty. And liberty is never arrived at by trying to figure out all the details or deciding that they don't matter. Ever. So, not even life. Now, I came up with another title just before I came up here. It's called Learn to Say I Can't. Did that surprise anybody? How many conversations have we all had about not saying, I can't? How many? I have no idea. But see this. This isn't the word that you think it is. This is can't without an apostrophe. It's a completely different word, but it sounds exactly the same. Learn to say I can't. So, anybody have any idea what I mean by that? If you're going to learn to say I can't, what would you be telling yourself? Yeah. There's that one passage in Isaiah, right? Talks about you'll hear a voice behind you if you like to drift to the left or to the right. This is the way, you know, walk in it. So actually the word can't has other meanings too, besides the one I'm thinking of. But if you are a marksman and you tip your rifle a little bit one way or the other, that's called canting. You can do it without knowing you're doing it if you don't have, well, really, really, really good form, if you're not paying attention. And that moves the axis of your sights off of the pathway of the projectile, and it will cause you to miss. And the same thing happens when you're shooting a bow. And so depending on which way you're canting, it will cause you to miss. And you have to be aware of that. Some target shooters and even hunters have levels on their bows. I sometimes think it's a little silly. Just work on your form. I can't imagine trying to pay attention to a level where, well, my eyes are drilling themselves into the hair I want to hit with my bow on a deer. By the way, this is important too. You need to decide what your target is and in life, right? You need to decide what your target is. You know one reason why a lot of people that hunt miss what they're shooting at? You know why? They're lousy shots. That is the reason why a lot of people miss, yes. But that's not the reason I'm thinking of. I discovered, maybe before I ever hunted deer, that one thing that happens to people is that it's bizarre when I think of it. They shoot at the whole deer. They don't pick a spot. It's like the deer is the target. Well, you know, a deer, his body can be like, you know, this long, and like this, and then, of course, then the legs go down to the ground, and then there's a head over here. So I don't know. Do you think the whole thing could be the target? When David was swinging that sling, he was going to slay Goliath, do you think he just thought of the whole area that Goliath took up as a target? I don't think so. So, you pick a hair. I mean, that's kind of an analogy. At the distance you're shooting, you can't see individual hairs, but I'm talking about you pick a very small point. Now, when I'm looking at a deer from up in the air, 26 feet, or on the ground, or below it, there's something in my head. I know where every organ in that deer is, and I know how it changes, depending on the angle. It's just in my head. There's also something that's not in my head perfectly that causes me to have some difficulty with actually doing the thing I'm doing with a bow. I don't have that problem with a rifle. Very frustrating. But you need to, we're on our way to glory, right? What's the target? Just getting there? What's your target? I don't like having to be real specific all the time. It really irritates me sometimes. I like to be nebulous. I like to have lots of freedom and room to move. I like to be able to just shift gears on the spot, even if it throws everybody let's go along with me into the ditch. Well, I mean, I'm not thinking about that at the moment. I'd like to just be, I don't know, spontaneous, is that the word? I've discovered, I think, that another word for spontaneous is chaos. So, anyway, learn to say I can't. And so what I mean by that is you lean a little one way, you lean a little the other way. You can do it while thinking that you're perfectly on the level. And you can get used to being in a leaning state, even physically. Like, I always think it'd be a great idea to go do the Alexander Method thing. Might take too much discipline for someone like me. I don't know. But an Alexander Method person can look at somebody and they just go, oh, they just know exactly what's out of line. And that person can think that they're perfectly in line, right? And you can get used to walking a little tilted because of an injury or something that hurts. And actually think that you're not tilted. It's better to be in line, to be everything lined up the way it's meant to be, because that's better for your whole body. But it's possible to get used to things and view them as normal, or the way that they should be. And the Lord doesn't really want that. So I said, not even life. Because if I read from Romans chapter 8, if I forget, remind me that this is the Father's Day message. I'll somehow connect it to fatherhood by the end if I forgot to do it. Okay. Romans chapter 8. I'll just start at the 31st verse. It's such a great passage. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, maybe I'll just throw in as fathers. Everyone's included, but I'll just emphasize fathers. What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us as fathers, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not give us fathers with him freely? Well, I should have put it somewhere else. How will he not also with him freely give us fathers all things? Now, all things only means one thing. It only ever means one thing. It means the thing that you don't think God is going to come through with. It always means that. The stuff that you have that you know you have, it's not really talking about. It's talking to you about the thing that you need that you don't think God's going to give you. Am I right? Sometimes I need to see a smile. I may be Swedish. That may be very deceptive. Sometimes I just need to see someone smile. Who will bring a charge against us as fathers who are among God's elect? God is the one who justifies fathers. You know, that means fathers don't need to justify themselves. And also that they shouldn't try when they're not justifiable. But since Messiah justifies us, we can rest in that, even though we goofed up. So, let's see, where was I? Who is the one who condemns? Messiah Yeshua is he who died, yes, rather, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us fathers. Who will separate us, fathers, from the love of Messiah? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword or the dentist bill or the stuff that needs to be repaired or the things that went wrong with the kids or with us? Just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things, we fathers overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us, fathers, from the love of God, which is in Messiah Yeshua our Lord, which means that nothing will separate our kids who have also put their faith in Yeshua, or our wives from that. So, but not even life. Okay, so, for I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Messiah Yeshua, our Lord. The reason I pick not even life is because the rest of it, at least to me, a lot of times just seems so simple. It's the life part that's difficult, isn't it? What's all the rest of that stuff to me? It's getting up in the morning and living. And that can't even separate me from Messiah's love and provision. What do you think? Are you with me? Not even life. Not even my own head. Not even my failings. Not my fears about life. Nothing I can live. I can live in him and for him and not be separated from all of this as I live. I'm not just looking forward to some day to come. I'm living with him now. Even in living now, nothing can separate me from what God has done, who he is, what he's promised, from who he says I am. And so it's a good thing. So this week, Torah portion is Korach. Now, during quite a bit of our history as a congregation, what do you think, Deb? On the week that Korach fell, didn't all kinds of calamities happen? More often, when that Torah portion came along, yes, and then I think one year we came to the conclusion, look, God's in charge. We don't have to be there on Korach Shabbat. God can take care of it. And I've heard stories from other people that lead congregations that all hell breaks loose that week. I don't know. Maybe the enemy just loves to mess with the Torah cycle. Maybe he's reminded of it that week. Maybe he tries to do it all over again. So, I'm not superstitious, and I try to make sure that I don't become superstitious. But whenever I talk about that, I always hear a line from a poem about parents in a certain island area, and it says, though they don't teach children how bamboo burns. And bushmen, when they're tracking a poisoned giraffe around the, takes quite a while for the giraffe to die, they track it for days. They talk about everything except what they're all thinking about. Is there one thing they're thinking about? Every one of them that's on that hunting expedition around the fire, they're thinking about the giraffe. And that's the one thing they don't say one word about. Because they're afraid that talking about it will give the giraffe power. Is there anything you're afraid to talk about? I'm not sure. You think being afraid to talk about something robs the problem of its power, or do you think it's possible that it could rob you of dealing with it? There are times not to talk about things. It does. There are things that we don't need to say that we shouldn't say, and there are things that we ought to say. Anyway, Korach came against Moses and Aaron, and what ended up happening to Korach? he went down in a burning ring of fire. Went down and the flames grew higher. Something like that. Didn't end so well for Korach, did it? Did Korach's whole family disappear? The no's have it. No, they didn't. They didn't. And this is part of this is where I'm gonna read you this. One group of Korahites joined King David in various military exploits and won the reputation of being expert warriors. However, the most remarkable thing to note about the sons of Korach is that during the time of King David, they became the great leaders in choral and orchestral music in the tabernacle. So, I want to talk about defining yourself based on where you came from. It tends to be a very human thing to do. Where you came from, and I think it works this way, whether you think about it all the time and talk about it, or whether you deny it or alternate between the two. Apparently, being descended from Korach didn't prevent these people from becoming what they became. Both mighty warriors and great leaders in choral and orchestral music in the tabernacle. Psalm writers, yes. So, who their father was didn't determine what was possible for them. And I also don't think they needed to stamp out where they came from. I think it's a valid and fitting part of the history to remember. I don't know that much about either one of my grandpas. I don't think I know anything about either of my great-grandpas. I know this one story about one of my grandpas that I've only known for a relatively short time. He had a son named Arnie, and Arnie desperately wanted a trumpet. And my grandpa told him no. And I don't remember if he borrowed money from somebody, but he just had to have the trumpet. And he got the money somehow, and he bought a used trumpet. And when my grandpa found out about it, I didn't know this until then, but the trumpet is an instrument of the devil. Maybe it's not anymore, but apparently it was then. What? Oh, maybe it was because of jazz. This is what my grandfather thought. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying a trumpet is the instrument of the devil. So anyway, Arnie got a hold of a trumpet. And when my grandpa found out, he took that trumpet, and he went out in the driveway, and he threw it down on the ground, and then he drove back and forth across it with his car. And then within a few days, Arnie had completely forgotten about that. No, Arnie never forgot that. I'm not judging my grandfather. I do think I can say maybe what he did wasn't the greatest thing. Maybe it wasn't the best way to handle it. It had a lasting effect on my Uncle Arnie. And but I don't think that day defined my grandfather. I don't think that determined what kind of man he was, what his inheritance in Messiah was, or whether or not he could do better than what that seems like to me. I can't go back and judge exactly. I wasn't there. I grew up with some difficulties in my family. That's putting it really mildly. You know, one of my brothers disappeared one day when we were moving from one state to another. One of my brothers took a bottle of tranquilizers and drove through the garage door, also a bunch of booze, without opening it. And I mean, these are just a few little details. It's not, they hardly define anything. I had struggles with respect to my dad. I also laughed at a bunch of his jokes. Slept in a bed he bought for me. Crawled under covers that he paid for. Did I say ate food that he bought? Lived under a roof he provided. I know he was really concerned about me one time when I was around 13. And he took me on a trip, just me, to Yosemite, before it was so mobbed all the time. I grew up with fears about things. And for quite a while, on many occasions, you know, I don't know, do you think sons have a tendency to judge their fathers? I don't mean like all the time or permanently or past total judgment that's irrevocable, but I mean daughters, mothers, daughters, fathers, maybe kids, families. I mean, don't we tend to have thoughts about each other? Have thoughts about our parents? What? Yes, but we can judge our parents. We can judge our fathers, and in one of my poems that I wrote along the way, after I had gotten a little older, it's about how we should judge our fathers. And I think part of it says, I too have flaws my fears keep me from facing. I too am now a man, and so much smaller than these trees. I got to a point in my life where whether I was over everything or not, I could see, because I had walked along far enough, just how flawed all men are. And it always hurts me whenever I hear particularly a son say, well, when I get married and have kids, it's not gonna be like that. And I have heard people say that, and I go, oh, oh. I say, like, please take it back. Repent. You don't know what you're doing to yourself with what you're saying. If there's something that shouldn't be the way you are, then get with God and seek to be what you should be, but don't ever decide you're not going to be something because your dad was that way, because you're going to end up exactly that way, except worse, if that's the way you approach it. You're cursing yourself. Start thanking God for what he gave you. Because if you don't, you're going to be worse than what you're judging, and you're not even going to know it. But everybody else will. That's the kicker. Well, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people. So, you know, I've been a father long enough now to know why I was terrified of it. When I was young and I wasn't even married and I had no kids, I was terrified of it. But I kind of thought I knew why. But now I know why. Now I know why. I have not been a perfect father. I love the passage in Ephesians where it says more than just that. It says, "Fathers, do not exasperate your children." It's like, okay, Lord, I won't. Thanks for mentioning that. And it's like, on, you know, how many days? Oh, I just exasperated my kid. I exasperated my son. I exasperated my daughter. Maybe it doesn't mean, fathers, listen to this verse and then you'll never will exasperate them. Maybe it means, maybe it's more like, you're going to exasperate them. And from any rational perspective, it's going to be completely understandable that they're exasperated. And then you need to accept that it was you that exasperated them. Aim at not exasperating them anymore, but you probably will. But repent. Admit it. I don't think either one of my kids has added up and kept a record of exactly how many times I've exasperated them, and that's to their credit. I can be exasperating, as some of you know. Right, Clark? Right, Bill? Thank you, Lord, for forgetfulness. You know, I realize that my fears of things are a much bigger problem than my flaws. There is no way to be a perfect father. There are ways to be better than what you may be. There are ways to become better than what you are. But you can't be perfect. There is only one perfect father. You can be weak and be a father. Oh, I just remembered part of this. In this week's after portion, Samuel, they're going to Gilgal, and it says they're going to renew the kingdom there. It's like, renew the kingdom. I haven't had time to look more closely at the whole thing. But I believe if you look at the passage and then study it, you'll find that underlying it all, if there was a kingdom to renew, it was really to refocus and reestablish that they're living in the kingdom of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But as you know, there was this guy named Saul who became king, and then there was another king after that. There was never supposed to be a king. And the notion that the kingdom needed to be renewed, it just really struck me strangely. But then it made me think about kings in general. And some of us grew up, well, a show named called All in the Family was on the phone, on the TV. And there was this little tiny castle. Where did they live?
Queens.
I thought so, yeah. In Queens. There was this little tiny castle with this little tiny king that reigned over it. And his name was Archie Bunker. It's a teeny weeny little king. But he was the king of his castle. And I just want to say that when it comes to being a father and a husband, I don't think there should be any king in the castle other than God. No king. I think the conception of male and fatherly and husbandly authority that it kind of seems like I grew up with, that a lot of people seem to have, is really inaccurate. And I don't see what being the king of the castle has to do with laying down your life as Messiah laid his down. I don't see what having God-given authority to tell other people what to do has to do with coming to do only the will of my Father and kneeling down and being a servant to the people that are my silly, kind of despicable disciples. I just don't see what being the king of the castle has to do with any of that. This is the one by whom everything that came into being was brought into being by Yeshua. And he came not to serve himself, but to do the will of his Father and to serve people like us. He didn't even have a castle. The Son of Man had what? Nowhere to lay his head. Did he have authority? Yeah. Yeah, he did. What did he use it for? To knock people around? Tell them what to do? To say, this is my will, I have authority, and therefore this is what will be done? No. No, he gave himself up for the sake of being faithful to his commission and for the sake of redeeming people who, quite frankly, didn't deserve it. We don't deserve it. But God's merciful and he loves us. Korach wanted to be king of the castle. That was his downfall. He didn't realize in his own head that what he was opposing was God. Not just a couple of men. So, I am so glad that my own failings, sins, misdeeds, misapprehensions, pathology, that none of that has separated me from the love of God and Messiah, and that none of what's wrong with me has determined what can be for me or my kids or my wife. I am so grateful for that. Because if that was what determined things, we would be as those who have no hope, at least in this life. But we are not those who have no hope. And so we shouldn't sorrow over life and the things that happen during life the way those that have no hope do. And we shouldn't complain about those things. And we should see them as opportunities to see the power of our God come through instead of making declarations that are firmly rooted in nothing but fleshly thinking and negativity, which I have done many times, by the way. I'm just going to read part of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? But what is our wisdom, by the way? My wisdom, your wisdom, what is it? It's something God has made foolish. For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Messiah crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Messiah, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. By his doing, you are in Messiah Yeshua, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that just as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. The scriptures say that when I'm weak, I am what? A prerequisite for God's strength being perfected in weakness is to be weak. And then to see that in the weakness, God can come through, and that it isn't our weakness that determines what can happen, but rather our yieldedness to God, who can come through and glorify himself, working through us what we couldn't do in our weakness as we trust in his strength. And so, I think an awful lot of what we need is really defined in crucifying the king of the castle so that the real king can reign in the castle. Messiah was crucified. I, as the king of my castle, was crucified with Messiah, that Messiah might live in me. And so if I have been given any authority, the purpose it was given to me is to serve and to bless, not to lord anything over anybody. And so the example of how to have authority is Yeshua, who laid everything down and served others. And if we're seeking God and wanting to serve the way Yeshua did and become more like Yeshua, then the emphasis will be on God's authority over us and what he desires that we do, rather than any emphasis on whether or not we were ever given any authority ourselves. Does that make sense? Anyway, I have something here for the fathers. How should we do this? And the fathers, by the way, aren't defined just as those who have children of their own. Happen to be torpedo levels. And later I'll show you exactly how to place this on yourself to see whether you're leaning one way or the other instead of being leveled out by Yeshua. Because they don't give the instructions along with these. I don't know why. They're just trying to save paper, be green maybe. But when you look at this level, I want you to think about where that little bubble is supposed to be in your life and whether or not it's like all the way up in the end of the tube there, because that's an indication that something's seriously out of alignment. You following me? So I don't even remember how we did this year. How should we give him out?
Me first.
What? Come on up, Ed.